Welcome to A New Prescription, where we explore modern healthcare, cutting-edge medical research and technology, and the complexities of healthcare politics. Join us as we provide insights and solutions to help you navigate the American healthcare system.
We have a truly special guest today. A longtime friend, a longtime colleague, and a longtime mentor, Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach. Andy was the commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. He was the director of the National Cancer Institute, had many leadership roles at MD Anderson, and that is where I first met Andy about 40 years ago, it's hard to believe, when I arrived at MD Anderson. And Andy, even then, was the go-to guy for our president, Charles LeMaitre, when important decisions and important actions needed to be implemented with the faculty's consent. And Andy was great at that. And then we had a new president, and Andy was the first chief academic officer under that president. And Andy must appeal to presidents because President George W. Bush appointed him to head the National Cancer Institute. And when there was a need at the FDA, President Bush tapped Andy once again. So today we want to focus on Andy's vast experience to understand exactly what he's done, what the FDA does, and why what the FDA does is so important to the American people. Andy, welcome to A New Prescription.
Thank you, Leonard, and thanks for the privilege of being able to share this with you. I liked your introduction, except for the fact that I thought you were my mentor, because I certainly learned a great deal from you and from your beautiful and brilliant wife, Jeannie Klarneman. And I finally remember those days when looking at macrophage activation, we were trying to change the outlook of not just pediatric patients, but the ones that I was taking care of, namely renal cell carcinoma. So yeah, you're reflecting on a history for me, Leonard, that I am so blessed and privileged to have been able to experience. So I'm grateful for all the things that you and others have made possible for me over those years.
So tell us, you've had a lot of roles, academic medicine, federal government, now you're in the private sector. How did the previous experience allow you to better navigate the next one? What's the learning curve at that level of leadership?
You know, that's a really profound question. And one of the things I look back upon that you and I were gifted with was the opportunity to come to MD Anderson. And I'm going to put that in a little bit of perspective for me as a surgeon, a urologic surgeon. We grew up in a paradigm of medicine that, quite frankly, was very egocentric. We sort of created incentives, like you had to be the first author peer-reviewed on the paper, you had to get your own R01 grant, and surgeons were particularly egocentric. And and what I came to appreciate when I came to MD Anderson is that no matter how good a surgeon I was, no matter what whiz-bang radical operations I thought I could do to cure cancer, I was not able to solve the problem. And that cancer's complexity required us to bring all of our skills together, whether we were surgeons, radiation therapists, medical oncologists, or researchers in a laboratory. So the lesson for MD Anderson was, in many ways, to become a basketball player rather than a golfer. And by that, I mean, it had to become a team effort in which there was interoperable performance, not just a matter of us getting together and wearing the same uniform, but being able to share, being able to collaborate, being able to value what the other person brought to the solution to a patient's problem. So the lesson I learned at Anderson was that sense of trying to bring disparate skill sets together into a team that was interoperable and interdependent, because we were all focused not so much on our own, you know, skill sets and accomplishments. Those were important. But what would matter most to all of us was, were we making a difference in that patient's life? So that's the lesson I carried with me. And you remember that I spent a lot of time at Anderson building multidisciplinary programs, like yep. the prostate program. And when I went on to NCI, I brought that same idea with me, that we had made so much progress, but where we had opportunities were, could we collaborate and cooperate and bring those riches together in a way that the whole became greater than just the sum of its parts. And because of the National Cancer Act in 1971, we went from what at that time were three cancer centers, Roswell Park, Memorial Sloan Kettering, and MD Anderson, to, you know, the portfolio of at the time over 50. So how do we come together? How do we become more strategic in being able to solve a problem like cancer by bringing the research, by bringing the development, by bringing the state-of-the-art cancer care together? One of the things I learned, and I'll comment on it, was whether I was at MD Anderson or NCI or FDA, one of the things that didn't change were the people. The people across all of those dimensions, like you, like Jeannie, were people who desperately wanted to make a difference in a person's life, in a patient's life. We were just doing it in different ways and on different platforms, but the people were the same. So everything changed for me, but nothing changed for me.
Was there a big difference where at Anderson you really got your hands on a problem as the primary mover, whereas the NCI you were always working through intermediaries almost uniformly?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things I think is really important about that is those of you who were at MD Anderson and stayed back at MD Anderson were really boots on the ground. I mean, you were on the front lines, hand-to-hand combat, if you will, with cancer. So you were the closest to the action and being able to see it and understand it and begin to unravel some of its mysteries and its secrets so that we could do more about it. When I went to NCI, that was like going from boots on the ground to more like an AWACS plane. I could see the whole terrain, and I could begin to see how some of those parts and pieces could more effectively perhaps come together. But I wasn't as much in close touch with the emerging reality. And the truth of the matter is, things are changing so fast. In our field, the research, the knowledge expansion was occurring almost beginning at an exponential rate, that it was really important to keep that connectivity. And one of the problems I encountered when I got to NCI and NIH was that although at Anderson I passionately believed in the importance of research, because without research, we could not be better tomorrow than we were yesterday. So research was critical, but it was a means to an end, not the end in itself. And at NIH and NCI, I began to perceive a culture in which research had become the end. And as long as we were funding the right number of R01s and creating more SMOR grants and more cancer centers, we were successful. And one of the countercultural things I ran into was to say, you know, research is critically important, but it's a means, and we need to focus on the end. And the end is, are we making a difference in the cancer patient's life? Are we eliminating suffering and eliminating death from this disease?
Do you think the fact that your past life included a lot of clinical work rather than bench research, you had a different perspective at NCI than a lot of people around you?
Oh, absolutely. And I'll give you a great story about that. So along the lines of me realizing when I got there that I really wanted to begin to help us focus on the end, eliminating suffering and death due to cancer, and beginning to see that what research had now been able us to do was to begin to see cancer as a disease process in which we were learning day by day the genetic, molecular, and cellular mechanisms that were driving that process, that were responsible for that process. And if we could begin to think strategically as to how we could then intervene in many and some ways in that process, we could change the outcome. So I put that goal out there, eliminate suffering and death due to cancer. I wanted to create the integrated interoperability that would get us there. And I had this horrendous backlash from the scientific community with some interesting op-eds in Science magazine saying something to the effect that we have the dumbest NCI director in our history because he doesn't appreciate how complex cancer is, and he just thinks we're going to be able to solve this problem. And you know me well enough to know that I love people telling me when they think I've got it wrong because I want to hear that. I want to understand why they think that. So I brought the Nobel laureates and some of those who want to be Nobel laureates together. And I won't mention his name, but one of them was particularly critical, and I had enormous respect for him. And they were beating me up about this unrealistic goal. I was creating false hope. I was just simply reiterating Nixon's war on cancer and creating expectations we couldn't meet. And I sat and listened to that for a while. And I said, you know, and at the time there were just men in the room. I said, gentlemen, I have enormous respect for you, that you're some of the most brilliant people on the planet. And I couldn't even begin to suggest that we could eliminate suffering and death due to cancer if it wasn't for the discoveries that you've all made, for which you've won Nobel Prizes. I said, but you're thinking of cancer as basic scientists who see all the complexity. I'm thinking about cancer as a clinician who sees the outcome. And so I think of you as the most brilliant people in the world who've been living on an island, and the only thing you've ever seen fly is a bird. And I come on the island, I take you off the island, I bring you to Dulles Airport, and I show you a 747, and I said, you see that bird? Let me tell you what that bird can do. That bird can leave here, go across the ocean nonstop, and land on a dime in Paris, France. It could come back and do it again. And if I was to say to you, looking at that airplane, can you tell me how that all works? You'd go, oh my gosh, that it'll take us forever to figure that one out. And I said, and you'd be right. But what you missed was I didn't ask you to tell me everything about how it all works. I didn't ask you to tell me everything about cancer. I just asked you to tell me, how do you stop that plane from landing on a dime in Paris, France? And I said, I got a 7-year-old grandson. If I give him a hammer, a screwdriver, and pliers, I guarantee you in 3 days, that plane's not going to Paris, France. I ask you to tell me, how can we stop cancer from killing someone? And the person who was giving me the greatest criticism at that moment said, you know, maybe he's got something for us to think about. Maybe we focus too much on what we don't know and not enough on what we do know and how we might be able to use that knowledge more effectively, strategically. And at that point, they started to have an interesting conversation about among themselves as to who had the best idea. One of them said, it's all angiogenesis. If you give me $1 billion, I can stop every cancer from growing. One said, we wait too long. By the time we find it, there's too much heterogeneity. We need a science of biomarkers. We need to find it early. One of the other ones said, we just got to keep working on cell death. I mean, and I sat back as they began to engage on where were the strategic weak points or opportunities in the cancer process. And you know, Leonard, I came from MD Anderson with a collaboration with Josh Fidler that was all about that. Nobody dies of local disease except brain tumors. People die from metastasis. So I said, if you could just slow down or eliminate metastasis, we'd stop people from dying. People were dying of lung cancer because we were not finding it early enough. So I funded spiral CT scanning for earlier detection. And if you could find it early, we could cure it. You don't have to die from it. It really, for me, was can we begin to get us to think about the problem differently, to not be overwhelmed with its complexity, but to be more and more excited about the opportunity, because the opportunities were expanding, as I said, exponentially. And here we are in 2025, with a lot
So you
of
went from being
opportunities
a
before.
bedside doc to being a strategic thinker about stopping cancer. Then you became the commissioner of the FDA, which is, let's face it, where the rubber really hits the road when it comes to patient safety and efficacy of drugs. So the obvious question I have now is it seems to me, as somebody who's been out of the business for a while, the rate at which drugs are coming through the pipeline is incredibly fast, particularly for cancer. I've never seen so many new drugs coming down. How can the FDA handle this volume of new drugs, making sure they work, obviously, and that they are safe? It seems that's a pretty big challenge now for the FDA. And it's not just in cancer, it's other drugs as well, of course. So how did you look at that when that became your hat?
Well, I had no intentions or ever expectations that I would wind up as commissioner of the FDA. Quite honestly, I've been at NCI 4 years. I put that eliminate suffering and death due to cancer goal out there, and I was working hard to try to create the infrastructure that would move us further in that regard. And the phone rang on a Thursday night at about 7 o'clock, and I was the only one in the office, and it was the White House. And I knew the person on the other end, and it wasn't really a question. It was, or Andy, we have a problem at the FDA, and the president wants to know, would you be willing to go over and take over? And that's not really a question, but and so the next day, I found myself the acting commissioner, and I did both jobs for 6 months because I said I just can't walk away from NCI. It's like a surgeon can't walk away in the middle of an operation and tell a patient something just came up. So I had no expectations of going there as commissioner, but I had an enormous appreciation for how critically important it was to what I knew we were being able to accomplish in cancer. And Mark McClellan and I had a very close relationship in terms of a partnership, because I had said to him when he was confirmed, Mark, all the things that we're making possible and that cancer is leading in this biomedical transformation from observing manifestations to understanding mechanisms, none of that's going to have value in touching a patient's life until it gets through the FDA. So how do we partner up so that the regulator is as sophisticated as the discoverer and the developer? So I came into that role with that same idea that FDA was the critical governor in terms of either speeding up or slowing down that approval process so that we got it right. And what the agency has to do to get it right is to be engaged in the total life cycle of those drugs. It's not a matter of being the gatekeeper and sitting there waiting for an application to show up to say go, no go. It really means that the agency has to be proactively engaged in the earliest stages of the conceptual development of those drugs, so that it knows about them, that it's sophisticated in the science that's underlying their discovery and their development. You need that intellectual capital. We need as brilliant scientists at FDA as we have at MD Anderson and the laboratories. We need as great clinicians who understand the diseases that we're directing those drugs towards at FDA as much as having them in the clinic at MD Anderson. So, but we have to have the connectivity. We have to have the integration of that. We need to build the FDA's workforce so that it's a modern workforce. And there's stories around how that was really a challenge when I went over there.
Talking about the workforce, in our discussion yesterday, we did talk a little bit about the effects of some of the reductions in force that have taken place at a lot of places, NIH, FDA, Social Security, everywhere. How do you have a unique perspective. Obviously, you've been a clinician, a researcher at an academic institution, the head of the NCI, and the commissioner of the FDA. Now you look back at an FDA that's considerably smaller than it was before, and yet the challenge to the FDA is greater than ever. What is our responsibility, which is what we were talking about yesterday? We, as graduates of this system, who have the best interest of the patients at heart and are concerned that the federal agencies upon which we all depend may not be able to operate as easily and as smoothly as they could before. What's our job now? What do we have to do?
Well, you know, first of all, I think for all of us, it's a matter of learning from the past as we try to shape the future. So the idea that the FDA workforce itself needs to be nurtured and developed is not a new one. Let me be specific about. So when I went over to FDA precipitously, as I indicated, I sort of ask a very simple question. What is this new business that I now am the CEO of? And in very simplistic terms, the FDA is nothing more than a data management business. It acquires data, whether it's in the form of a drug application or an adverse event. It acquires it, it aggregates it, it analyzes it, and acts upon it. And then it accumulates that experience. So I asked myself, what do critically I need for that kind of an enterprise? And the first thing you need is intellectual capital. And the second thing you need are the tools of information technology. Well, on either side of that equation, we were in catastrophic shape. The FDA workforce had shrunk. The average age was 47. 30% of the FDA workforce was already beyond retirement eligibility. And so you could imagine taking over a corporation where one-third of your people could walk out of the door tomorrow and make more money than they were or be rewarded differently. And the agency was under attack. It had no friends. I mean, at NCI, it had more advocates I knew what to do with. At FDA, none. You either thought we were too slow or you thought we were too fast, but nobody thought we were exactly right. So my point was to you about the question you're asking is we should always be looking critically at the FDA workforce. Do we have the right number of people? Do we have the right kinds of people? Do we have the right skill sets? One of the things I noticed was, our experience at MD Anderson, and I mentioned Jeannie before, with liposomal encapsulated MTP to ma stimulate macrophages. So we were dealing with nanotechnologies. I did not have expertise at FDA in nanotechnology. I had to create a task force to begin to develop that. So it's appropriate to constantly be assessing the workforce, skill sets, numbers, experience. I created a fellowship program because I knew that we had to continue to nurture and bring along the next generation of intellectual capital. So I would welcome today a very critical view of the FDA workforce from the point of view of, can we match the expertise, the intellectual capital, to the challenges that you have alluded to? The volume, the speed, the very change in the nature of products. We're not just now today challenged with regulating small molecules or biologics. We've got cells. We've got gene therapies.
I'm going to ask you to tell the Penn story.
Well, you know, the Penn story for me, one of the things that cancer has blessed us with is, as we've tried to conquer that horrendous disease, which is the most egregious disorder of life, growth and differentiation, we learned an awful lot about the normal processes of life. And so stem cell biology is a direct outgrowth of cancer biology. And so now we're beginning to see our ability to regulate normal life processes, not just eliminate the disease ones. But when you look at regenerative medicine and you look at the mysteries of how a blood vessel forms or how an organ develops and the complexity of that, you realize once again, we're back to integrated interoperability, right? And there's great experiments. I just gave this talk on and referenced old textbooks that showed that a child that broke their leg and it wasn't set properly and it was crooked, as they walked around on it, the leg straightened out. And the only people who capitalized on that very old finding were dentists, who figured out that if they slapped a wire on a kid's teeth, they could have beautiful smiles and they would probably do quite well not having to just drill cavities anymore. But we never picked up on that in any meaningful kind of way because we didn't really truly understand it until now. Now we understand the osteoblast on one side, dissolve, you know, made bone, the osteoclast, and now we're seeing that all over. So how do we get to that problem? Well, I walked in one morning for our Senate director's meeting. We made rounds every morning. We had everybody in my conference room to talk through what was going on in all the centers. And we did all that. In the meantime, I had brought my pen in and I was just twirling my pen and twirling my pen and said at the end of the meeting, you all been kind of looking at me twirling this. And let me tell you what this is. I invented this last night. This is not a pen. What this is it's a carbon nanotube in which I have impregnated genetically modified stem cells that can differentiate into endothelial cells or smooth muscle cells. And I've encapsulated along with that nanoparticles that have a portfolio of growth factors that can influence which direction that differentiation is going in. And I want to make this into a blood vessel. So it's a device, it's a drug, it's a biologic, it's all of it. And how are you going to regulate it? And there was a little bit of silence around the table as people were pondering, and I kept twirling and said, tell me what you want me to tell you so that you'll approve this as a blood vessel. And finally, one of them said, Commissioner, it'll depend. And I said, that's the wrong answer. You can't ask me to spend $100 million to develop this and then come back for you to then tell me what I should have done so that you'd approve it. I said, you're phenomenal at regulating components. Phenomenal. You're the world's gold standard for regulating a drug, a biologic, a device. But the future is regulating interoperable systems. So we got to think about solutions to problems like we think about the computers industry does. Andy Grove's going to always think he's made the world's greatest microprocessor. but it's not worth 5 cents until he puts it together with somebody else's hard drive and somebody else's software and gives me a laptop or a PC. So patients want solutions to their problem, and the solutions are almost invariably in the future going to be these complex interoperable systems. So we need to begin to create the horizontal integrations across these vertical centers so that we get beyond just the combining a biomarker and a therapeutic. We got to combine active participants in an that are working interoperably. And I think they've moved along those lines. I mean, the Center for Excellence in Oncology, but there's so much more that needs to be done in terms of seeing the future and what advances in science and technology are going to bring to the FDA. So it's not just the volume of drugs, as you pointed out, Leonard, that are being developed on multiple fronts and devices, et cetera. It's the complexity of them as well that's the challenge.
It's usually about now that I ask my son if he has a question that, and he gets to the heart of the matter. So what's your question for today, Andrew?
No, I don't have one that gets at the heart of the matter, other than how did you get the teams to work in that interoperability model when before they were siloed?
Well, there's, you know, that's actually a very profound question. You're sitting there quietly, like most of the times, and this is actually, I got to tell you how often this occurs. Your dad and I have given lots and lots of lectures, and when you go and give lectures and there's a lot of gray-haired people in the room, you get some good questions. But when there are a lot of young people in the room, you get some phenomenal questions. So thank you for that one. So the first thing is culture. Okay. You got to change the culture. I alluded to some of that when I stepped over to FDA. And I alluded to the fact that I grew up in a culture that was very focused on making us egocentric, you know, me and my own little white ball. I was taught to play golf and to try to be a really, really great golfer, you know, right, best in the world. But it was just me and my own little white ball. We got to change that culture. We got to get people to understand that I can't be as good as I need to be without you, and vice versa. So I use the example that when I say go from golf to basketball and skip over track and field, it's the idea that I could be the greatest point guard in the world. I go down the court, pass the ball behind my back, and you're not there. The ball goes out of bounds. I look like an idiot. Right. We didn't score, and we may lose the game. But it was because you weren't where you were supposed to be, and vice versa. If you're where you're supposed to be and I don't get you the ball, you don't score. So that interoperability is a cultural mentality change. We got to then carry that forward functionally into, we got to start thinking horizontally. And that's a really critically important thing that, once again, cancer has taught us. So your dad will tell you that when we move from observing manifestations to understanding mechanisms, he could look under a microscope and he could see a piece of chromosome that calls a Philadelphia chromosome and know absolutely that that patient has chronic myelogenous leukemia. But until he figured out, until people like him figured out what that was in terms of this translocation of two genes that were driving an abnormal kinase pathway that was causing unregulated proliferation of these white blood cells, we didn't know how to fix it. But once he knew that, he knew a kinase inhibitor would do it. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, that drug, Gleevec, did. But where's the horizontal thinking? If it works there, where else could it work? Mm-hmm. So guess what? A totally, completely foreign tumor, not even closely resembling a leukemia cell, called a gastrointestinal stromal tumor, winds up responding to the same drug. We developed a drug to stop those blood vessels from feeding a tumor. Guess what? The most prevalent best application of that class of drug is right now? Wet macular degeneration of the eye. Who would have ever thought that a cancer drug would be the best drug we've got for people who are going blind? Second, change culture. Two, break down the barriers and think horizontally. If this works here, what else might it do? Who do I need to pursue that? Where's my strategic partner? And I think you're finding in biology today, some of our greatest partners are actually live in the world of physics, engineering, and mathematics. And believe me, if we don't figure out how to incorporate AI into biology, we're going to be behind the curve again. So how do you change it? You change it structurally, functionally, and culturally.
Andy, this has been a fabulous time, and we're going to have you back because I've got these three more questions that I've got to get to. But I promise we'll
Well,
keep it to a reasonable time amount of time.
you figured out a long time ago that the Italian in me likes to talk.
Yeah, but you said a lot. I mean, you covered what the beginning of what I want to get to. I do want to get to some specifics in the future if we can have you back in a couple of months, if you can fit us in. Andrew, you have any last words?
No, I think it's a great insight to see what your past, how you've implemented it, and how it can be actually applied to any field, including, my own in technology of integration and horizontal thinking to be able to get an end goal. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing with us your experiences.
Andy,
I'll be happy to share this gray hair with you anytime, Andrew.
gray hair's better than
And
no hair. Let me just tell you that. Take
thank
care, Andy. It was great to see you.
you.
Thank you so
Thanks so
much.
much. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining A New Prescription. We're so excited that you stopped by. Please join us on our social pages at A New Prescription and also subscribe to our YouTube channel at A New Prescription YouTube. Remember, your health is the most important thing to you. We'll see you next time.